ebook publishers and marketing services company, Just Imagine It, Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, your favorite fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes, PRX, and right here locally on KSKQ 89.5 FM, Ashland, Oregon, art and entertainment news and views. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audiobook Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $12.99 per month. That's Downpour.com. On this episode, Christina Annapau hits the big screen again in Altergeist. Mike Kravinsky's got a new movie out as well called Geographically Desirable. And New York Times bestseller, The Litigators, by John Grisham. And our audiobook feature right after the news you want to know.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
I'm Charlie Stanton.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
And I'm Jerry Renfro. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. So, I don't know if you guys heard this, but Netflix has inked a four-picture deal with Adam Sandler. They are basically stepping into the realm of the studios. You know, they already went down the road of Blockbuster, and then they took over a lot of the TV duties, and now they are going into the movie business. So they made a deal with him to produce and star in four movies exclusively to be aired on Netflix. They also have worked a deal to do Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Green Legend. It's a sequel, prequel, one of those to the, you know, the wildly popular Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. The important thing about that is who they did the deal with, which is Harvey Weinstein of the Weinstein Company. So these are not small players in the market. Netflix has really made a big push to say, not going anywhere. Here we are. Check it out. One of the reasons that Netflix cited for doing it is because Adam Sandler's movies are very popular on Netflix. They get watched a lot over and over again, sometimes, you know, by people watching the same movie over and over. And Sandler said, I got a quote here, this is pretty funny. He said, "When these fine people," meaning Netflix, "came to me with an offer to make four movies for them, I immediately said yes for one reason and one reason only, because Netflix rhymes with wet chicks." Would we expect anything less from Adam Sandler? No. So let the streaming begin.
Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't say it in his Adam Sandler voice.
He might have. For some reason, I can't get that on the paper, though. You know, I read the story, so it just didn't come through. But I could imagine it.
Yeah. You know, when I heard the, you know, about the deal, right? I mean, Netflix has already been, you know, real heavily, you know, into House of Cards, right? They did House of Cards.
And Orange is the New Black.
Orange is the New Black is the most popular TV show on any format.
Mm-hmm.
Netflix is huge, right? And this is twice this has happened in their career. You know, when they left sending out DVDs and just going to streaming, I mean, everybody jumped ship. You know,
yeah. This will never work.
Yeah, and their stock went down, you know, to like $70 a share, and you know now it's like $700 a share. But they're going more to original content, right? Because they let you binge watch. If you want to watch all four, shows, you can watch all four shows.
Yeah, they release their TV a season at a time,
but
so you don't have to wait every week.
They also do something that Amazon doesn't do, and Hulu doesn't do. Is that all their stuff is commercial free?
Yeah.
Which is nice. Yeah, because I just signed up. I've had Netflix for years, and you know we're in the process of moving, and they messed up our cable, and I went ahead and signed up for Hulu Plus this time. And I'm amazed. I'm paying for that service, yet I still have to watch commercials. After years of being with Netflix, I've become spoiled to not having to watch advertisements.
Right. Oh, really? So even though you get a premium, you pay for the premium service.
I pay for
service,
it. Yeah, it's $9 a month, I think, or
they
$8.
They still have commercials.
Yep.
Yeah.
Every,
yeah,
like,
I think one of the
5
deals,
minutes.
The deals is like on my Kindle Fire, right? I got the Kindle Fire HDX, which is their new, you know, big thing, right? And you can get a lot of these apps. Like, one of the apps is, like, for ABC, you know, for sports and stuff like that. But what they do is this. They make a concession. They'll start the show, right? And they'll say, this show is brought to you with limited commercial interruptions. If you watch it on Hulu or you watch it on Amazon or you watch it on iTunes or whatever, you're going to get a commercial, but it's going to be like 10 seconds long.
Right.
Or maybe 20 seconds long, you know, so enough to where you can put up with it.
I don't know. I still feel like it takes me out of it. And I think that's – I was going away from Netflix, but with this announcement and the additions to the catalog, I think I'm going to go back to Netflix.
Dude, where else can you watch anything you want? For $7.99. Yeah. Plus, Netflix lets you share your account with everybody. Yes. And
right, which I do. I've got like 4 people.
Care.
Yeah.
Remember, Cyrus? We did a story
about this. Yeah, a couple
months. Right. And then Netflix made an announcement, and they said that we know that you can use up to 5 to 7 devices at once because a lot of people have different devices. So if you're watching an Adam Sandler, in your kitchen, and, somebody's watching Orange is the New Black, in another room or whatever, it doesn't matter. And their bottom line was this: you know what? We don't care. You know, we limit it to 7, and the only reason we limit it to 7 is because of the broadband. Netflix made a sleuth of money last year over what they did the year before. I mean, they made like over $152 million more in profit this year, but their stock went down a lot, and they got beat out by HBO at the last second announcing that they are going to streaming.
Yeah, I read about that. Right,
yeah.
So you don't actually have to subscribe to their
right.
cable
so,
programming.
Yeah, you don't have to like call Charter or Time Warner, whoever your cable provider is, right, and say, I want to watch Game of Thrones, right? Okay, yeah, well, it's going to cost you $100 a month.
Yeah.
Now they're doing a deal, where you can just stream Game of Thrones. You don't have to watch everything else that's on.
Finally.
Right. So it's a good thing, Kayla, because that's what drives the market is competition.
I wonder if Netflix will eventually pick up this one. Here's how long it's been since Serena started development. It was first reported that stars Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper were cast in Suzanne Bier's drama on January 30th of 2012, 10 months before the duo would appear on the screen of Silver Linings Playbook, and 2 months prior to Lawrence's star-making performance in The Hunger Games. This one has been on the shelf for a while. Now, though, Serena is here. Well, sort of. Bier's adaptation of Ron Rash's 1930s set novel will premiere during the London Film Festival in October and arrive in the UK theaters on October 24th, but there is no US release date at this time. However, this is a bummer considering the plot. Lawrence and Cooper play Serena and George Pemberton, newlyweds who move to North Carolina, create a timber empire, and once there, Serena realizes that she can't bear children, which sets her out on a path to destroy George's illegitimate son.
I love Jennifer Lawrence and Silver Lining Playbook. I watched Hunger Games because all my girls read the books, right? So I watched Hunger Games, and I honestly, it did nothing for me.
No.
Yeah, I thought it was
no.
like action fluff.
Yeah, and I watched Catching Fire, and it was supposed to be better, and it did nothing for me.
The costumes,
yeah.
The costumes were it for
costumes
me.
The costumes were great.
That was the only thing that did it for me.
Yeah, and you all know how much I'm into fashion.
Oh,
so,
totally.
But the thing, the movies didn't translate for me as well as the books. I read all 3 books because we published them, so I got to proof them.
Nice.
Right, so I read the books. And it's funny because, when I got the books, I got them, just before they were being released. And my son said, are you getting ready to get in touch with your inner little girl? Because we all have different sides,
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But she's got a nice franchise out of it. What I was going with this is, it was this new movie. I think, because I've seen her in other movies. Like Silver Linings Playbook just did it for me. When I saw her in
great
that
movie, yeah,
I said,
movie.
Like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh. This chick can really act. She's not just, a good-looking girl who's going to come out and shoot bows and arrows and save the day. She was a great actress in that movie. I actually went and saw it twice, because, I saw it once, and it was so good. And then I told my friends about it, Cyrus and my daughters and, friends of ours.
Yeah, we saw it together, yeah.
yeah, we all went back and saw it together. I said, you got to see this movie. It's great.
My question for you on that was, so they cast Lawrence and Cooper like before they blew up?
Yes.
Is that kind of what happened? So yes. Now they've got them locked. Kind of, they have them locked in. They're finally going to be able to do it. I can see their schedules have been busy between the Hunger Games series, the X-Men series, because Jennifer Lawrence is in that, the independent films. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And Bradley Cooper, The Hangovers, and
he's always busy. Limitless.
I think it's a real, you know, hats off to the directors, because the directors who cast these movies were before these people were stars, and they said there's a chemistry there between these two.
Yeah,
and they have plans to release it in the UK on October 24th.
They were in American Hustle together too, weren't they?
Yeah, right.
Right, so there's another time.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. In fact, when you were telling the story, I thought for sure you were going to say American Hustle, and I didn't even know a couple of those other ones. So, yeah, and they obviously work well, because Silver Linings Playbook, spot on. That movie was awesome.
What was your favorite scene in Silver Linings Playbook?
The jogging scene.
All the scenes are good. For me, my all-time favorite scene is this. You know, big football fan, like a lot of the guys in this room are, and I imagine some women too.
No.
Okay.
But thanks.
Okay. Only if the Ravens are playing.
Robert De Niro did such a fantastic job in that movie, right? And there's a scene in the movie where, you know, Bradley Cooper's laying in his bed, you know, and he's obviously got a few mental issues. And this is a true story, by the way. I don't know if you guys know this or not, but a little bit of trivia, but the kid that keeps knocking on the door going, can I take a documentary of you?
Right.
Yeah. Right? That's the director's real son. Huh. And that's what the movie was written on.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. But anyway, Robert De Niro comes in and wakes up his son, right? And you think it's going to be a big scene because he's been seeing this girl and he's just like, you know.
This is the big speech moment.
This is the big speech moment. You're right. Seeing this girl, you know, and are you sure she's right for you? Because, you know, she's had some issues in the past.
And he's had his issues, obviously.
Right. I mean, I'm just saying she's dated around and he doesn't, you know, you know, that's what you think you're going to see, right? And instead, you see Robert De Niro wake his son up and Bradley Cooper goes, Dad, what is it? What time is it? What's going on? And De Niro, who is such a fantastic actor, goes, son, we have a serious issue going on. And he wakes up and goes like, what? What's the matter? Is something wrong with Mom? What's going on? He goes, if the Eagles don't win on Sunday, do you realize how much money I'm going to lose? You know? And when I saw that scene, I thought about me and my two boys, you know, going like, we got a serious issue. If we don't win this game, we are like out of the playoffs.
Oh, that's funny.
It's fascinating, you know, what appeals to people, you know, and that's what's making movie going so cool. And speaking of things that, you know, that make the, you know, appeal to some people and don't appeal to other people, right?
Right.
Some people see it as art. Some people see it, you know, as graffiti. Some people see it, you know, as like, why'd you do that? You know, Cyrus has got this great story and I just can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, well, it is controversial. A $44 million Indianapolis hotel commissioned graffiti artist Nick Walker to vandalize their parking garage. So, you know, it just kind of seems out of this world that they would actually pay somebody to come in. And he wanted to work after hours, nocturnal hours. So this is genuine graffiti. And go around their parking garage and paint these elaborate Banksy-esque type portraits and different, you know, bubble lettering. A lot of kind of things that you see in graffiti. And he is, on their website, mentioned as a contemporary of the famed UK street artist. And
yeah, we did a story on Banksy, didn't
yeah.
we? About a portrait he did of in Germany.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah,
he
took
up
a piece of regular art and then, like, Banksified it, you know, and then returned, like, took it to the Goodwill and donated it. Then some guy bought it for, like, $20 or something and then found out that it had been, you know, altered by him. And that made it worth, you know, millions of dollars or something crazy. Yeah,
Banksy,
I remember we talked about that.
Would go into art museums and he would put up replicas of similar pieces, but he would change, like, this, that, and the other. Like, he would have a landscape with a whole bunch of litter he'd thrown in there. And then he'd just walk in with a trench coat and hang it on the museum wall without
That's
any
awesome.
Kind of permission or anything. And just
guerrilla art. Yep.
One of the first stories that I heard on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There when I first started listening to your podcasts was about the Banksy having an anonymous sale in Central Park or right off the corner of Central Park in New York City where he was selling his works, but they weren't advertised as Banksy.
Right.
And you guys covered the story about how Banksy had anonymously sold many pieces that day under
under a nom de plume kind of thing.
He wouldn't sign them. It was his material. He did it. And he sold it to people for reasonable prices.
Just pretending he was some random street artist.
Like he's a regular street artist. Like, you know.
That was one of the best stories I had ever heard. I became a listener of Get Behind Me and Stay There after that. I was really impressed.
And I love the story because we're looking at some of these pictures. Obviously, our viewers can't see them, but they can go online and take a look. And it's at the Alexander Hotel. And one of the comments that I read is it's like, he says he didn't do this to get caught. But what can you say? You don't expect to check into a $44 million boutique style hotel and see this in the parking lot.
I guess it really is one of those, if you can't beat them, join them. That way at least you have control over what the graffiti looks like. Definitely. If they had planned on doing it anyway.
Yeah, it really pushes the boundaries of art itself and, brings painters more into the fold. With all this other, technology, music, movies we talk about all the time. But, painters, kind of have faded into the background. But, these kinds of artists pushing the envelope, they join the mainstream again. And, these pictures you were talking about, they look, unreal. The funny thing I was thinking of is of another vandalist, like a real street person comes in and paints over these.
Yeah, that would be irony.
I go ballistic.
If graffiti gets graffitied, because it really is blurring that line between what is graffiti and what is art. I think, the best description for graffiti you could say is art that you didn't commission.
Speaking of joining them, I heard a story a couple weeks ago of someone who was arrested and taken in on graffiti charges, and he said that the police stopped and watched the entire piece
and
being
then
created and then arrested him. They stood there and watched him complete the piece before chasing him down.
I can believe that because these artists, they're phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
And they were watching a masterpiece at work, and they go, I'm watching till the end.
Yeah.
And then they're like, we still got to do our job. We're sorry.
Still going to run you down afterwards. He knew they were watching.
I'm sure they just wrote him a ticket, and he got out of it, But there's a story here, and it's kind of near and dear to my heart, and I'll let her tell you about it.
Steven Tyler of Aerosmith.
Love that
guy. He's embarking on a solo career where he'll produce a country album for the first quarter of 2015. Tyler will be spending his time in Nashville, also known as Music City, working on his upcoming record. He has a quote here. "I'm going down to Nashville in January, February, March, April to write and see what we get," says Tyler. "We're doing an album is kind of like panning for gold. You get so much sand and dirt until you find a little nugget and you work on the nugget. I always go backwards, Oh, Aerosmith frontman. So this is really exciting. You were even saying you heard about his, or you actually heard his country song.
I actually heard his country song because we got an advanced copy of it because we wanted to use it for one of our book reviews, so got a hold of his people and they said, absolutely, go ahead and use it. And it was really, really good. And he just has that type of voice, again, like a good artist, like the three of you, But I'm really looking forward to hearing this country album because I think it's going to be something that's going to be, it's going to bring him to another crossroads. As amazing as Aerosmith is as a band, let's remember who writes all their songs, Steven Tyler.
Right. Yeah.
And he is the voice, right? When you hear the voice, it's Aerosmith or it's him.
And he says here he had to do it Aerosmith-ish, which was more rocked out, but there's a piece of him that just loves country so much and he's not sure what kind of country that is, but it's got the fifth harmony and anyone who knows who the Everly Brothers are, it's those kind of melodies that are
nice.
I remember it.
I love the Everly Brothers. That sounds great. I'm pretty excited about this. I love Aerosmith. I like Steven Tyler. I'm not a huge fan of country music, but I have certain ones that I like, especially older country. I love the Everly Brothers. I love that whole Garden Party, Hank Williams Sr. era. Johnny Cash. I'm a huge Johnny Cash fan. So I'm really looking forward to this. If it's in that vein of what we call old country, I think I don't see him failing. Really,
And you know what? I saw him on the Kennedy Center Honors, which I did not get invited to, but, you know.
Unbelievable.
It was unbelievable because I thought I was going to be the keynote speaker, and they said, no, you know, President
Obama. Not this year, Charlie. Not this year.
But they did, you know, all these different artists always come out at the Kennedy Center Honors and do versions of, you know.
Whoever's being honored song, yeah.
Right, or music productions or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so they had, like, you know, No Doubt come out and do Hello, Goodbye. And the Foo Fighters came out to Get Back. And, you know, and these heavy-duty bands, and they did their own versions of them, right? And they sounded good. But then they brought out Steven Tyler at the end, right? By himself, without Aerosmith, right?
Yep.
But he came out, and he had a full band behind him. He used McCartney's band, which was a good move, right? And he came out, and he's dressed just like Steven Tyler. You would never know he was 68 years old,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, still got the same mic stand, got the scarves hanging off. Everything was Steven Tyler.
So he comes out, and he goes, I've never been prouder to be standing on Pennsylvania Avenue and Abbey Road. And then he goes, hit it, right? And the band starts getting into it, and they start playing that melody off the Abbey Road album. He gets to the part where he's singing that song, Carry That Weight, and, you know, the love you make and all that stuff, right? Anyway, they panned up to the audience, and Paul McCartney is crying.
Yeah, he was actually crying. It was so good.
He was actually crying because Tyler was that good.
It was that good. Charlie played. I went over to his place one time, and he was like, dude, you got to see this. And he played it, and I was almost moved to tears. And it's not even my music. It was so good. Let's face facts. Steven Tyler could put out, like, accordion's greatest hits, and it'd still probably be a gold record. You know what I mean? Like, the guy is great.
Yeah, but it was his voice.
Yeah, that's what it was. You agree with me? Steven Tyler could put out anything, and it would probably be good.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, and that's how it is with these A-list musicians. You know, like, I was watching Jimmy Fallon the other day, and they had Sting come on, and he gets them to sing ringtones. And, you know, those ringtones would sell in the millions. You know? And it's the same with Steven Tyler. It's the same with any of these guys.
No, I think that's so cool, man. You know, as you obviously after you've been in the business that long, right? You're established. You know. Okay, like if you hear a Beatles song, you know it's a Beatles song, right? But when they get older and the age, they start experimenting with different music that they probably would have liked to have done when they were younger.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have sold, right?
Now they have the license to do it.
And I would have loved to have seen what Jim Morrison would have been recording, you know, had he lived. You know, I think he would have went in a different direction too. You know, then I'm not just going to sing the blues and rock and roll anymore. I'm going to, you know, go with something, you know, different than that.
Yeah.
All right. Joaquin Phoenix and cast help make Inherent Vice a noir nonsense affair. Ooh, this sounds good.
It does.
Earlier this week, the first trailer for writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson's latest film, Inherent Vice, took the internet by storm, and you'll expect a similar explosion online when the entire movie makes its world premiere at the 52nd New York Film Festival. But if the viewers occasionally have trouble following exactly what happens during the course of this 2.5-hour slice of sunny California noir, don't worry. The director doesn't expect you to piece everything together. Although Inherent Vice is adapted very faithfully from the 2009 book by Thomas Pynchon, the first of the famously reclusive author's novels to reach the big screen, Anderson was equally inspired by an older example of labyrinthian detective flick, Howard Hawks' 1946 version of The Big Sleep, starring Humphrey Bogart. As Anderson put it, you have a deeply written and beautifully profound stuff mixed in with just the best fart and poop jokes you can imagine. Indeed.
Yeah, I saw the preview that Charlie sent it to us, and it looks like a great movie. I mean, you know, a lot going on, and, you know, almost like Pulp Fiction, you know, when it came out, there's still like a mysteriousness to it. You know, I guess you got to go watch it. It looks like could be a lot of fun, yeah.
You know what? And I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, the film here is increasingly way out there, Anderson, along with like Christopher Nolan and Quentin Tarantino. And I love movies where you see them. The first time I saw Pulp Fiction, I saw it and I didn't get it, like a lot of people, right? And then I saw it again, you know, later on, and I still didn't get it. And so I'm... But then, you know, the third time, you know, I saw it, I started, you know, picking up on more, putting pieces more together because the movie was so well made that in the beginning, You know, you're trying to, like, they're going from one scene to another scene to this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense.
Right, yeah.
And then you start putting it all together. And I don't think anybody's ever figured out what was in that briefcase.
Oh, yeah. I've always speculated what it could be. It has a golden glow to it, but that just could be because it's so valuable that it puts off a golden glow and it's not really actually gold. I don't know.
Well, it's funny you should mention Quentin Tarantino because it says that New York Film Festival will be one of the only places to see it because it was shot in 35 millimeter film and it's increasingly on its way out. But Anderson, along with Christopher Nolan and Quentin Tarantino, are doing their best to slow its departure.
Well, it'll slow its departure, and I think one of the reasons is because they are so successful. They will, if they want to shoot in 35 millimeter, then they're going to let them do it.
They'll keep doing it, yep.
Right. Yeah, and the thing, you know, like along with these movies, and I like these type of movies, and especially now with streaming that we talked about earlier, is so cool that you can watch a movie. It used to be like, okay, now you got to pay $12.50 to watch a movie. Now you got to pay $12.50 to watch it again. And I still don't get it right. And then at some point you give up on it. But with streaming, you can watch it as many times as you want. Then you finally get it. And then, like, I remember finally when I saw Pulp Fiction, I got a text, right, from my son. And it came out of nowhere. And he sent me this text. And he goes, me and you, Sunday, whatever the date was, right? You know, he goes, we're going to Tinseltown, which is here in Medford, Oregon. And it's a nice theater, right? Mm, okay. And they were doing a one-day only showing of the original Pulp Fiction to celebrate its 20th anniversary, right? And so we went and saw it. And when I saw the whole thing again, you know, I was just, you know, after, you know, all those years, I was like, it all makes sense, you know? But I still couldn't figure it out, you know, is it gold, is it drugs, is it money, what's in the case? Yeah. The only thing that I remember is when he goes, Vincent, are we happy? And he goes, oh, we happy, you know, but when they interviewed Quentin Tarantino about the 20th anniversary, you know, and the big question was what was in the box? And he goes, it's whatever you want it to be.
Oh, and he goes, of course he's not going to tell us.
And they asked him, was there really something? And he goes, yes, there really is something in there. And no, I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Oh,
it's part of the allure of it, yeah. Right? You know?
Is Art with Holly Lorien Adams.
Time is art. Whether traveling through or living local in Southern Oregon, chances are good that you've driven by beautiful, gigantic metal sculptures of flowers and wondered who created them. The answer may likely have been Oregon's metal artist Cheryl D. Garcia. Cheryl is an experienced, award-winning artist, and her talents bring a broad range of work that include fine art, sculptural work, gates, and home accent pieces. Cheryl is especially known for her giant California poppies at the edge of her hometown in Jacksonville, Oregon. She's been creating metal art pieces since 1994. Having created hundreds of artworks, sculptures, and private commissions, she's established herself as a well-respected and renowned regional artist. These sculptures, some of which have hidden bird food and water catchment vessels, have inspired many people over the years and provided for local and migrated birds, and quite possibly, home for the bees. Her work reflects and extends the inspiration she finds in the natural world, blended with the whimsy and magic that she infuses with it. I once asked Cheryl D. Garcia which her favorite tool, and she said her acetylene tank, hands down. She uses art on her side to create amazing, beautiful works of art many have seen throughout Southern Oregon. You can find works of Cheryl D. Garcia at greatmetalworks.com. Be inspired and inspire others. Live your masterpiece. Check out other artists using time as art. I'm Holly Lorien Adams.
And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Hello, wherever you are. Are you dancing on the dance floor, drinking by the bar? Tonight we do it big and shining like stars. And we don't give a what, cause that's just who we are. And we are, we are, we are.
Hawaiian Christina Anapao looks familiar to many because of the Emmy-winning HBO series True Blood. She now stars in her biggest movie since Black Swan, a sci-fi thriller that will have you on the edge of your seat. She speaks about it with myself and President Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton, in this interview.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me and I'll Stay There. Today, we're really privileged to have on Christina Anapao. And she is an actress. You all know her from such things as True Blood, Black Swan, Curse, Cruel Intentions 3. And, of course, we all we got to hear about your stint on General Hospital. So, so welcome. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. You know, I want to start off, you know, and you know, for our listening audience out there, and you know, you're a pretty famous movie star, so everyone knows who you are. What was it like on True Blood?
Okay, well, True Blood, first of all, was just an amazing show to be on. It was a dream come true. I mean, I've been a big Alan Ball fan for a long time, and my first audition, my first and only audition for the show, was a really quick process, was with him, and I did the audition one time, scene one time through, and left the room, got a call a couple hours later that I had the job, and so incredibly excited, obviously, and it was just such a wonderful experience to be part of such an iconic show for the few seasons that I was. I feel really lucky.
Yeah, you know, and were you surprised by the success? I mean, that's a huge hit on HBO.
It had been a pretty successful show before I joined the cast. I wasn't, you know, I was already really aware of how popular it was, but it was so wonderful just to step into that and to step into instantly having all of those, the Trubies, we call them, the True Blood fans. They're just so loyal and amazing. And I have not experienced a better fan experience than the Trubies.
Wow. Now, your new movie, well, one of your new movies, you know, Altergeist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You play Teresa in that. And you know what? Just for our listening audience, I know that, you know, this is going to, you know, it's going to be broadcast, you know, around the world. And it's not, we don't have the video, but we do have a, you know, the trailer is so amazing. Let's let them listen to a little bit about what they can expect.
King's Ransom Winery is widely considered as one of the most haunted places in the United States.
There's an abundance of violent deaths and unexplainable phenomena. If there's something here, we're gonna find it.
Make you afraid. Whoever scares you the most, they know what it is.
No!
Make you see things.
We're all gonna die.
You don't wanna see. Make you do things. You don't wanna do. Have you seen them? They're beautiful. It's not a ghost. Are you afraid? That's what they like.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
I play Teresa. She's a director-producer, and she takes her team of filmmaker/ghost hunters up to a haunted winery in Sonoma, and they definitely discover what they went for and a whole lot more.
This is Holly here. So you graduated at 15 and you went on to college right after that. And yet everything kind of shifted around and then you went on to tour with Destiny's Child. What was that like?
That was amazing. I like a lot of little girls, I grew up, or a lot of little girls in the 80s anyway, I grew up wanting to be Madonna and loving Madonna so much. And I, even though I was having a lot of success in the acting world, I really wanted to be a singer and a pop star still. So I had been taking voice lessons from a really cool voice coach in the LA area. And one day just confessed that to him. And he thought I was taking voice lessons to improve my acting or to add to my acting. And I said, no, I really would love to get a record deal and be a singer. So he started introducing me to people. And next thing you know, I had a record deal and was a three-girl group, and we opened for Destiny's Child on the MTV TRL tour. It was just an incredible experience.
And you did perform for them for each of the shows that they were doing?
Yeah, wow. For the entire tour.
And how about the record that you cut that year? What happened to that record?
Well, I ended up leaving the group to go back to the acting world, and I ended up replacing myself with a very talented dancer, singer, who was super happy to be a part of the group. And I went and took a job on General Hospital.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah, what was that like?
That was great. It's such a, again, another really iconic show to be a part of.
You know, that show is so iconic.
Yeah, it is. I was lucky because I was recurring, so I wasn't having to work every single day. But for the series regulars on soap operas, they have pages and pages and pages to memorize every night. They really become very skilled at memorizing new material and on a nightly basis. I don't know how they do it.
I don't either, I tell you the truth. And now you're a big movie star. You know, you and James Franco, and you guys were both on General Hospital.
That's true. We were.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you obviously went on to work on some really, truly beautiful things. How was it working with Wes Craven?
Oh, he's wonderful. It's a very paternal sort of energy and really takes care of everyone on set. And it's very quiet and calm and gets what he wants from his crew and his cast in a really, really very quiet, understated kind of way.
What a great
answer. Was it like working with Charlie Sheen? You were on, I didn't know you were on anger management.
Yeah, it was great. He's, you know, he's got such this negative stigma against him, I feel, out in the world. People always ask what it was like working with him, and I think are expecting some sort of salacious, crazy answer. But he was just very gracious and professional, and we had a wonderful time.
You know,
very welcoming.
I've talked to a few people that have worked with him, and you know, he had this whole, you know, thing, you know, with the winning, and you know, he's got, you know, a wild reputation. And anyway, I and a lot of people would expect to hear, like, you know, oh, Charlie was crazy on the set or whatever. We talked to John Cryer, and he's just like, he's a hard worker. He's fun, and he's fun to be around, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what he is. He's a really hard worker and really fun to be around. And just, yeah, every moment was a pleasure on that show with him and with everybody else. Great atmosphere.
I saw that you had been playing piano and taking ballet since youthful age. So I was wondering if that was still part of your life or if you get to use that ever in your movies or in acting.
I haven't gotten to use piano yet. No, that's interesting though. Maybe I will get to. I feel like with ballet, all my training sort of came full circle with Black Swan. So maybe there'll be an equivalent with piano in some movie.
Yeah. And what type of genre inspires you most out of all the genres that you've performed in? You know, you're not really pigeonholed into one place. You have kind of an open market here of different things that you're involved with. Do you like, you know, mysteries or suspense or the thrillers? What strikes you the most at home?
I like period pieces. I just did this really artistic little short film of all things called Four, like the number four. And it's actually up now. I believe I have it up on my Facebook, which is just / Christina Onapow on Facebook. People can check that out. The filmmakers just released it a few days ago. So I like period pieces a lot. And I also like voiceovers. I've been doing a lot of voiceovers recently, and that's something that I like the speed of it. And I've really been enjoying those. So, but beyond all that, what I'm really enjoying these days is business. I'm about to launch a company in 2 weeks called Color It New. And it's a fashion product We're not saying what it is quite yet, but in another couple weeks, it'll be out there. So
that's intriguing.
You can go to the website and you'll get some hints, and you can go to the Facebook and Twitter and whatnot. And we've been posting a little bit here and there, but colorittenew.com is the website.
What was it like being the sexiest woman in the world in 2003?
But I'm bummed.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know when you're 23 years old, you know, who knows what I was thinking? I have no idea. I'm sure I was very, very happy. I find it very humorous whenever I see it written someplace, or when somebody brings it up now. Uh-huh. I definitely don't feel like one of the sexiest women in the world at all. So,
well, if it's any consolation,
I
showed my husband your picture last night, and he said, "Wow, that woman is gorgeous."
Thank you. Thank him for me.
I will. He was very honest and sweet about it.
Yeah, well, you can, right now on the webpage, you enter your email, and then you'll be alerted you'll be one of the first to be alerted right when it's launched. So we have a lot of limited edition versions of the product coming out in the beginning. So people will definitely want to go there as soon as it's launched and get their hands on what they can before we run out.
Have you ever been to the Ashland Independent Film Festival?
No, for some reason, I've never been to that one. I've been to a lot of different film festivals.
Yeah.
Self-Medicated, this movie I did about 10 years ago. It was like the most award-winning festival film of 2006, I think it was. So that year was a really busy year of festival going.
But yeah. Congratulations on that.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
That's going to be a lot of fun traveling around, you know, and every night's like, you know, the opening night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. It's a lot of fun.
Well, we've really enjoyed having you on the line today with us for Get Behind Me Now, Stay There.
Thank you so much.
It's been good. Thank you.
Thank you. And hey, have a wonderful, wonderful day today.
Thank you. You too. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
To learn more about Christina Anna Powell, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com.
It's not like we're dead. Was it something I did? Was it something you said? Don't leave me hanging.
Mike Kravinsky's new comedy will be available early next year. He talks about the making of the film with the president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another really amazing, exciting interview on Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we are really honored to have on director Mike Kravinsky, and he is going to talk to us about his new upcoming film, Geographically Desirable, which has a release date for 2014. Now, first of all, welcome, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah. And you know what? I watched the show, and, you know, you sent me the link. You know, I saw the preview. I watched the show not once, not twice, but I saw it like, you know, four or five times. And every time I saw it, I liked it even more. I think you've got a real winner on your hands.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And for all of our listeners out there, why don't you give them your definition of what you think the series is about?
The film, I guess the best way to describe it is the tagline, which is an overworked, sleep-deprived executive woman whose life is derailed when she inherits a house and a small dog in a quirky town.
In the beginning, you know, she's all, you know, like all businesslike, and then she, you know, inherits the house where it's
right,
which, you know, she didn't even want to go to the funeral, but ended up going.
Right.
And, you know, then it starts like taking on this magical little charm. Like she starts falling in love with this community. Like, you know, hey, there's another life, you know, besides, you know, chasing the cheese like one of the rats, you know?
Right. Well, exactly. Originally, I was advertising this film, you know, for the festivals and things as a romantic comedy, but the reviewers that have seen it basically say, this is a really nice film and it has romantic comedy traits to it, but it really sort of transcends that because it's really about kind of the growth of this woman who's just completely work obsessed. And the relationship part is strong, but it's also about just getting your priorities straight in life.
Yeah, you know, I like I said, I watched it several times. I really enjoyed it. You know, lots of times, you know, directors will and writers will send me stuff, and I'll look at it, and
you know, it just doesn't, not my cup of tea, you know. When I saw this, I thought, wow, this is really, really good. I mean, you know, it was refreshing. You know, that's the word I'm looking for.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, I'll tell you that I, you know, I feel really fortunate because, you know, a lot of people are making films these days, you know, because the technology has gotten so inexpensive. And, you know, and this is a low budget film. It's not Hollywood. I mean, it's a lot of money to me, but by Hollywood standards, it was pretty low. And we had the best cast, the best crew. I feel really blessed. We found this great town to shoot in, and they all got on board. You know, everybody wanted to be in the film. I mean, you know, I never had any trouble with extras, and it was just a wonderful experience.
You know, I was going to ask you that question because, you know, obviously in the beginning, it looks like New York City, but this mythical town, where is it? Where did you actually shoot?
Well, it's actually in southwestern Virginia. The urban scenes were shot in the Washington, D.C. area and suburbs like Arlington and McLean, Virginia. But the small town was shot in Floyd, Virginia, which is about 60 miles from the North Carolina border in southwest Virginia. And this town is actually, these people are just, it is just the coolest town. I mean, basically, it's this combination of artists and people who do farming and ranching, and they have small businesses in there. And, you know, it is just this wonderful, you know, conglomeration of people, you know, that are all sort of like in different, you know, that have different lifestyles. They're all working together. And, you know, the town itself, Floyd, Virginia, the town itself is small. It's about 425 people.
Wow, that is small.
Yeah, the county of Floyd has about 15,000. But the town itself, where we shot all this stuff, it was 425. And there's a scene where we recreate a jamboree, a Friday night jamboree, and we recreated it on a Wednesday night. And we had so many people that wanted to volunteer to be a part of this, we actually had to turn people away.
Wow.
You know, these kind of things are important when you're shooting in a kind of an out-of-the-way location, you know, particularly when it comes to extras and things like that. Is like, you know, sometimes you would, you know, we're, the town is also about an hour from Roanoke, Virginia. And we could certainly get extras there, but, you know, they may have had to put them up in hotels and things like that. The town just got on board with this film, and they were just wonderful, just great people to work with.
Well, you know what? You're the writer and director, so where did you come up with this concept?
Well, I actually, it's my background. You know, it's sort of write what you know. I worked in TV news for 29 years. I worked for ABC News in Washington, and back in 2010, there's a general downsizing in news, and, you know, the big organizations are, you know, not...
They see the writing on the wall.
And so in 2010, they offered me a buyout, and, you know, and I took it. And, you know, just to sort of try something different, you know. And my wife and I, we, you know, on board, as long as we live frugally, we'll be fine. And so far, so good. And, you know, and this film came about, you know, just kind of writing what you know. You know, the you know, the background of this woman, the scenes in TV news are basically, okay, maybe so they're a little bit caricatured, but they do come from my experience.
Well, you know what, let's talk a little bit about the lead actress.
Blair Bowers.
Yeah, she was fantastic.
Isn't she great? You know, she was a DC-based actor, and I was really fortunate to get Blair. You know, she's in Los Angeles now. She's, you know, trying to make it in L.A., you know, and she saw the posting for the film, and she figured she'd give it a shot, you know, one last thing to do before she left. And originally, I had her cast as a different actor in the film, but the more I thought about it, I was like, she's just so good. She's just, like, such a natural. And she had this wonderful ability to be kind of cold and self-absorbed, but also at the same time kind of be warm and, you know, kind of like you want to root for her.
Yeah, you know, you do. And when I was watching in the film, there's a scene where she was talking with, you know, three or four other ladies around the table, and they're talking about men and mm-hmm. what they do and what they say, you know, and and they're all having a conversation, and it was such a it was a short scene, but it was so clever and well put together, because it was hysterical, because everything that the other women from the small town told her was going to happen when she went on this date is exactly what happened.
Right. Well, exactly. And it's like it's just a little aside, but then everybody remembers when all the things start happening to her. And, it worked out really well. But as I say, Blair is just, she's just so, just so amazingly professional to work with. And, she had wonderful ideas, and the way she portrayed Nicole in the film was just, I lucked out.
So it's going to be released in 2014. So you're kind of running out of time here.
It actually is. I'm saying actually 2015, January 1st, 2015, because it actually has been accepted in the New York City Independent Film Festival.
Oh wow, that's a big one.
The Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. And DC's Real Independent Film Festival. And we're hoping for more news. There's still a number of festivals that we haven't heard from. And, hopefully it'll have a good festival run. And then, the life of an independent filmmaker. Then I got to start, selling it to distributors and stuff like that. But one way or the other, the film is going to, whether it's going to be on Amazon and iTunes and, hopefully Netflix and things like that, one way or the other, it's going to be, available, in early January.
Great. So our listeners can be able to view like a trailer or something like that sometime around the holidays?
Well, the trailer is out now. If they go to geodesire.com, you'll be able to see the whole, the actors' bios and scenes from the film. And, there's this ongoing thing about grilled cheese sandwiches, and so we thought it was kind of cute. We all the actors and the crew and everybody, we all got together and we found our favorite grilled cheese recipes. And so if you want some really good grilled cheese recipes, you go to geodesire.com.
Okay, that's what we'll do. And once you get this off and running, what's your plans from there? Are you gonna keep writing and directing, or
Oh, yeah. I'm working on actually a couple of things now, and, just in the beginning stages of writing, and, my hope is, my goal is, besides everybody who was involved in the film, becoming successful in one way or the other, just everybody using this as a springboard for their own personal success, I would personally like to have somebody else pay for me making the film. I would love somebody else to be confident enough in my writing and my directing ability to say, here's seven figures and have at it. So,
well, we talked to a lot of, producers and executive producers, I'll pass your name along, sure. we just did an interview with a guy that was the producer for, a movie called Girls, Gun and Gambling. And it's a comedy. It's a crack up. And it's got Christian Slater and Gary Oldman and Powers Booth and Dane Cook and all these big stars in it. And I asked him,
Wow.
Yeah. So I asked him, how do you get to be a producer and stuff like that? And he goes, dude, I just put up the money. They do the rest.
That's great.
Okay. Well, I got to tell you, man, it's been great talking with you. And we really look forward to seeing this. And, now we all have something to do on January 1st, 2015, because we'll be watching Geographically Desirable. And, I got to tell you, Mike, it's been great talking with you, and we'd love to have you come back on when we get closer to release.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. Hey, thank you, and have a wonderful day out there.
Okay. Bye-bye.
To learn more about Mike Kravinsky, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com. Chasing waterfalls, please stick to the rivers and the lakes that you're used to. I know that you're gonna have it your way or nothing at all, but I think you're moving too fast. The Litigators, a New York Times bestseller.
The partners at Finley & Figg, all two of them, often refer to themselves as a boutique law firm. Boutique, as in chic, selective, and prosperous. They are, of course, none of these things. What they are is a two-bit operation always in search of their big break. Ambulance chasers who've been in the trenches much too long, making way too little. Their specialties, so to speak, are quickie divorces and DUIs, with the occasional jackpot of an actual car wreck thrown in. After 20-plus years together, Oscar Finley and Wally Figg bicker like an old married couple, but somehow continue to scratch out a half-decent living from their seedy bungalow offices in southwest Chicago. And then change comes their way. More accurately, it stumbles in. David Zink, a young but already burned-out attorney, walks away from his fast-track career at a fancy downtown firm, goes on a serious bender, and finds himself literally at the doorstep of the boutique firm. Once David sobers up and comes to grips with the fact that he's suddenly unemployed, any job, even one with Finley & Figg, looks okay to him. With their new associate on board, Finley & Figg is ready to tackle a really big case. A case that could make the partners rich without requiring them to actually practice much law. An extremely popular drug, Crayox, the number one cholesterol reducer for the dangerously overweight, produced by Verrick Labs, a giant pharmaceutical company with annual sales of $25 billion, has recently come under fire after several patients taking it have suffered heart attacks. Wally smells money. It almost seems too good to be true. And it is.
Their referee was Rochelle Gibson, a robust black woman with attitude and savvy earned on the streets from which she came. Ms. Gibson handled the front, the phone, the reception, the prospective clients arriving with hope, and the disgruntled ones leaving in anger. The occasional typing, though her bosses had learned if they needed something typed, it was far simpler to do it themselves. The firm dog, and most important, the constant bickering between Oscar and Wally. Years earlier, Ms. Gibson had been injured in a car wreck that was not her fault. She then compounded her troubles by hiring the law firm of Finley & Figg, though not by choice. 24 hours after the crash, bombed on Percocet and laden with splints and plaster casts, Ms. Gibson had awakened to the grinning, fleshy face of attorney Wallace Figg hovering over her hospital bed. He was wearing a set of aquamarine scrubs, had a stethoscope around his neck, and was doing a good job of impersonating a physician. Wally tricked her into signing a contract for legal representation, promised her the moon, sneaked out of the room as quietly as he'd sneaked in, then proceeded to butcher her case. She netted $40,000, which her husband drank and gambled away in a matter of weeks, which led to a divorce action filed by Oscar Finley. He also handled her bankruptcy. Ms. Gibson was not impressed with either lawyer and threatened to sue both for malpractice. This got their attention. They had been hit with similar lawsuits, and they worked hard to placate her. As her troubles multiplied, she became a fixture at the office, and with time, the three became comfortable with one another. Finley and Figg was a tough place for secretaries. The pay was low, the clients were generally unpleasant, the other lawyers on the phone were rude, the hours were long, but the worst part was dealing with the two partners. Oscar and Wally had tried the mature route, but the older gals couldn't handle the pressure. They had tried youth, but got themselves sued for sexual harassment when Wally couldn't keep his paws off a busty young thing. They settled out of court for $50,000 and got their names in the newspaper. Rochelle Gibson happened to be at the office one morning when the then-current secretary quit and stormed out. With the phone ringing and partners yelling, Ms. Gibson moved over to the front desk and calmed things down. Then she made a pot of coffee. She was back the next day and the next. 8 years later, she was still running the place.
Brilliant. Superb. The kind of grab-a-reader-by-the-shoulder suspense story that demands to be inhaled as quickly as possible, says the Washington Post. John Grisham, whose name has become synonymous with the modern legal thriller, used to work 60 to 70 hours a week at a small South Haven, Mississippi law practice, squeezing in time before going to the office and during courtroom recesses to work on his hobby, writing his first novel. There are currently over 275 million John Grisham books in print worldwide, which have been translated into 40 languages. 9 of his novels have been turned into films, as was an original screenplay, The Gingerbread Man. He lives in Virginia and Mississippi. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com. Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
I'm Sarah Simerson.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there. When youthful pass away, blue, what will they say about me?